Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today, legislators will consider cutting education funding this session, possibly by $100 million, but not everyone agrees.
This idea that somehow the state will be better off if we cut education, it's, in my opinion, absurd.
Meanwhile, Wyoming school funding debates bring up conversations about the place of extracurriculars in budget cuts.
This can work this way. It's not ideal, but it's going to help us keep it going.
And the pandemic has complicated efforts to revitalize indigenous languages, but the move to online learning has opened doors for far-flung tribal citizens.
It gives me the opportunity to carry on culture that maybe I wouldn't be able to just because of the lack of proximity.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. For the last several years, the Wyoming Senate in particular has been promising to make major cuts to education funding. While there have been reductions, K-12 education has not faced the types of cuts the Department of Health, the University of Wyoming, or other areas of state government has faced. This year, there seems to be momentum to make those cuts, but the current proposal may not be constitutional. K-12 education requires a certain amount every year that's based on a funding model. The model lists a number of things a district needs in order to offer an equitable and quality education. A big part of that is the basket of goods, or 10 content areas that must be taught, like math. Senate Minority Leader Chris Rothfuss says there's another key point.
The state has a complete obligation to raise revenue as necessary to meet the needs of the cost of education for a high-quality education that's equitable throughout the state.
This language came from the Wyoming Supreme Court, who in the 1990s forced the state to change the way it funded education. In other words, if they are short money, Rothfuss says lawmakers need to raise taxes for education, something they haven't been willing to do. Rather, the legislature has been using reserves to make up for a $300 million deficit. That has led to a bill that cuts $100 million out of what they pay school districts while also imposing a tax for future revenue. House Majority Floor Leader Albert Summers.
That bill is really a vehicle for the discussion on how we want to fund K-12 education going forward. How do we want to manage our shortfall?
One issue is that courts indicated that across-the-board cuts are not constitutional, but Senate Majority Leader Ogden Driscoll adds that they need to do something different.
We will deal with education either by ourselves or via the courts in the next 6 years. When you look at the trend lines, it's absolutely not sustainable to do the status quo.
School districts say they have been willing to help out to a point. Jubal Yenny is the Albany County Superintendent.
You know, we certainly are working with the legislature as well as the school board to figure out ways that we can be more frugal and provide education with fewer dollars. And we've done that over the past 5 years when everything started going in a different direction. And I know my fellow superintendents have done that as well.
But Yenny agrees with Rothfuss that lawmakers should have figured out a way to find money to address the deficit. He says Casper Representative Steve Harshman actually developed a white paper with a number of solutions that was essentially ignored.
Doesn't seem to be the time ever for people to say, well, let's take a look at some other options. And that may be more frustrating than anything.
Senator Rothfuss says cutting back on education is a bad idea at a time when the state needs to develop smart people to get it out of its economic doldrums.
This idea that somehow the state will be better off if we cut education, in my opinion, absurd. Nothing good will come for the state of Wyoming for cutting education.
House Majority Leader Albert Summers says they have few options at the moment. He notes they'll burn up their reserve account in 3 years at this point, and then things will be even worse. Summers adds it's too early to determine if their approach is constitutional.
You know, we'll try to do our best to find a solution. We may not, but we will work at it. And then the courts will ultimately, districts will decide what they need to do. And then ultimately the courts will decide if it goes to them.
But that court piece has rarely gone well for the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. Schools are going to have to look hard at the cuts they'll have to make over the coming years to deal with Wyoming's fiscal crisis. And while lawmakers debate changes to the system, many districts are thinking about how to make the necessary cuts now for their next budget. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has more.
In 2020, Governor Mark Gordon asked school districts across Wyoming to start considering what a 10% funding cut would look like. More recently, lawmakers are suggesting cuts around 6.5%. And now, with budget season approaching, schools are deciding what they can and can't live without. Jay Harnack is the superintendent of Sublette County School District No. 1. He says the district's finance committee has been thinking about all of the options.
I think they just sort of sat down and tried to come up with a balanced approach that would, as much as possible, not impact the classroom. And I think that's what the proposed budget reduction plan reflects.
In Pinedale, the district is proposing a $1.1 million cut. Harnack says this includes cutting a couple of sports teams, like men's swimming and the Nordic ski team. He says out of the district's $17 million budget, sports and activities take up only about $6,000, or about 3%.
It's the budget line item in our general fund that outspends greater than any other budget in terms of what it's funded and what we spent.
But parents, community members, and students expressed outrage and suggested other options like community fundraising or a pay-to-play model where students would need to pay fees to participate in activities. And after the public input, the school board agreed to postpone any action. And Sublette 1 isn't the only school district in the state considering such options. But Wyoming High School Activities Association Commissioner Ron Laird says it's important to remember, like in Pinedale, these activities are usually a small line on a budget, and cutting them won't solve many problems. But it does create a big reaction.
It seems like every time, historically, a school wants to get rid of a, whether it's an activity, a music program, or a sport, or whatever, that's the one that fills the boardroom when they go to, a lot of emotion gets involved in those, and, sometimes the academic cuts, they don't even show up for the school boards.
He says schools have learned how they can save money on activities without making big cuts due to the COVID-19 pandemic. One example is how schools have adjusted their schedules to move away from costly overnight trips.
This can work this way. It's not ideal. We're not playing all the schools or teams that we'd like to play, but it's going to help us keep it going.
Laird says the pay-to-play models that are being suggested can bring up concerns about equity, meaning there are some families who cannot afford to pay for their children to participate in activities.
If it's set up in a pay-to-play that way, I think then you get into the haves and have-nots, and unfortunately, a lot of the have-nots are some of our students that need activities the most. I mean, it gives them an opportunity to be a part of a team and to have a safe haven, and a lot of the coaches become great role models for those students, and it's really something that they need.
Wyoming School Boards Association Executive Director Brian Farmer says how the state funds education will have to change in the long term. But for now, districts will have to adjust until lawmakers figure out how to fund education. Farmer says this will all eventually lead into a bigger conversation about what residents and policymakers think Wyoming education should provide.
We have created a system in Wyoming to be proud of. So I know that as the legislature struggles with questions of appropriate funding, it's a question of how do we continue to provide this program that we've built.
Farmer says similar conversations about the cost of administrators and staffing are likely to come up as well. It's a conversation that's been ongoing for years, but will finally have to be resolved. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
When we come back, Savannah Marr notes that the pandemic has complicated efforts to revitalize Indigenous languages. That story is coming up on Open Spaces.
This time, on the Modern West, the outmigration of rural youth is one of America's great migrations.
I wanted the hell out of here so bad. I think I left the day after I graduated. Literally, like got up in the morning, threw a bag in my car and left.
But could they be the easiest to lure back? Mountains in the Rearview Mirror, part 10 of our Ghost Hunting series. Listen at themodernwest.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The pandemic has complicated efforts to revitalize Indigenous languages. Many programs have shut down entirely, especially in rural communities. But others are using technology to reach their students and to bring far-flung tribal citizens into the fold. The Mountain West News Bureau Savannah Marr reflects on her own experience.
It's a Wednesday evening in December. 5 p.m. means the end of my workday and the start of Wampanoag language class. I'm zooming in from my home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Other students join us from our homelands in southeastern Massachusetts. And from Boston, New York, West Virginia. After an opening prayer, we get to work. Like most Indigenous people in America, I live away from my tribal community. My career has taken me to Pueblo country, and it's not likely to take me back to Wampanoag homelands anytime soon. Until recently, that meant I'd given up the opportunity to learn Wampanoag Atua'onk, the Wampanoag language.
I didn't realize how many students want to come and couldn't.
Tracy Kelly is a linguist and a teacher with the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. She's long dreamed of creating online language learning resources.
But there wasn't complete community buy-in.
The biggest hang-up, she says, was that digitizing our language could make it vulnerable to exploitation by outsiders. But then the pandemic hit.
It was kind of like the perfect green light, you know? I was like, okay, you're on. Good thing you've been working on this because we need stuff now.
Kelly built a secure language learning website just for tribal citizens and their family members. It's called Kanusi, which means talk to me in Wampanoag.
So teaching on Zoom has definitely presented its bit of challenges. You know, it's just a whole different way of relating to people and building community online.
Plus, Zoom hasn't increased accessibility for everyone.
It's not ideal.
Robert Hall is a language teacher on the Blackfeet Nation in Montana.
We live in a place of a lot of poverty. A lot of people just don't have the technology suitable for online learning.
So he broadcasts on the Res radio station.
Ah-ha! What a morning, what a morning.
And in addition to this Thunder Radio broadcast, he streams the show live on YouTube. And he posts video lessons to the site, complete with a cast of puppet characters who tell Blackfeet stories and sing songs in the language.
It is important to admit and to accept that we need to be entertained.
Hall's videos have traveled far beyond his res, reaching far-flung Blackfeet across the U.S. and Canada.
I'm very unapologetically res-centric. But with that being said, just because you're not going up on the res doesn't mean that you ought not have access to our knowledge.
Minya Gaines and her daughter Danielle Urbina are grateful that their tribe has adopted that sentiment. They're citizens of the Acoma Pueblo, an hour west of Albuquerque, but they live on the East Coast.
I think my mom was the one who saw the language class, and I was like, we have to do this.
Her mom says even though she grew up in her tribal community, her older relatives didn't teach her the language. They were Indian boarding school survivors.
So they weren't allowed to speak their language at the boarding school, so some of it got lost.
The class, hosted by the Acoma Learning Center, is helping to break that cycle of loss.
I felt more like I knew who I was afterwards.
Yeah, same. I think it means everything. It gives me the opportunity to carry on culture that maybe I wouldn't be able to just because of the lack of proximity.
As for my language, Tracy Kelly says Wompana Atua'onk is only going to get more accessible.
I would love to have video games, computer games, you know, apps like you would see on a kid's tablet. Let's have those in Wampanoag, you know? I'm envisioning taking this way farther.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
It turns out that a number of right-wing groups took part in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and at least one of them was founded in our region. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck has more.
Three known members of the anti-government group the Oath Keepers were the first to be charged with conspiring to commit violence just a couple of weeks after the riot. But this group didn't start in D.C. or even on the East Coast. A man named Elmer Stewart Rhodes was in Montana when he started the Oath Keepers in 2009. Sam Jackson researches political conflict and wrote a book about the organization.
The group was really organized around this perception that the federal government is increasingly tyrannical.
Jackson says the Oath Keepers formed as the patriotism of 9/11 was wearing off. Its name is based on the oath that members of the military and police swear to, specifically the bit about protecting the Constitution.
And of course, Rhodes and his friends had very specific understandings of what it means to keep that oath and what sorts of enemies to the Constitution there were that people needed to worry about.
The group rallies around conspiracies about the deep state and government officials. Hillary Clinton has been a frequent target. Today, COVID-19 and mass voter fraud are major talking points. Right-wing media organizations that thrive on conspiracy theories and false narratives have helped drive the outrage. Take the media outlet InfoWars, founded by conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
I'm Alex Jones, your host, Stuart Rhodes, riding a shotgun.
Jones recently had Rhodes on his show where they talked about an alternate reality. Rhodes warned that Chinese communists were working with President Joe Biden to sever all lines of communication in the U.S.
What Patriots should be doing is in their own towns and counties, coming together, squaring away their comms, getting CB radios, ham radios.
The Montana Human Rights Network tracks and counters disinformation from groups like militias and white supremacists. Rachel Carol Rivas is with the nonprofit. She says the Oath Keepers are dangerous specifically because they're influencing members of the military, veterans, and the police.
The Oath Keepers, quite frankly, have taken that legitimacy that law enforcement offers, and they've manipulated it to give credit to a movement that is otherwise, you know, counter completely to what it means to be leaders in a nation, in a county, in a city, in a state.
That said, Carol Rivas is hopeful the U.S. can push these ideologies back to the fringe. Still, she says the January 6th insurrection will have an effect.
Some folks will be emboldened, but other folks will be shocked and potentially deterred, because it's one thing to fantasize about doing it. It's another to actually go to jail.
But Carol Rivas says just one person following this ideology can still pose a threat. She points to the 80s, when law enforcement started cracking down on militia groups and there were successful lawsuits against white nationalists. One of those suits took aim at a guy named Louis Beam Jr., who just came up with another tactic.
He started advocating for the leaderless resistance, the cell strategy and the lone wolf strategy.
Basically, splitting up to avoid getting caught. And lone wolves have a history of producing more casualties. That includes the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Timothy McVeigh, a decorated Iraq war veteran and anti-government extremist, killed 168 people, including 19 children. Carol Rivas says to prevent these acts of terrorism, we need to help people gradually discern fact from the wealth of misinformation that's out there.
I don't think that you can kind of unravel the whole thing at all at once, but you can poke holes, right? Like you can poke a hole in that water balloon and it begins to leak.
She says we also need to talk about where our government systems are failing us and find ways to fix them together so these conspiracies and extremists don't exploit them for their own gain. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Mm-hmm. Coming up, it's avalanche season and things have gotten bad lately. We'll have that story coming your way on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This time on Human Nature, Damon faced trauma growing up in his small village in Alaska. His goal was to play pro basketball, but reaching for his dreams revealed an even larger purpose.
My senior quote was, "If all I'm remembered for is being a good basketball player, I've done nothing in my life."
Beyond the court. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. 90% of avalanche deaths are triggered by a person. In the first week of February, avalanches in the United States killed at least 14 people. This is the highest number of deaths in a seven-day period in 100 years. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska chats with American Avalanche Institute educator Jenna Malone. Malone says a big contributor to this season's high number of avalanche deaths is the fact that we got snow early in the fall, but more did not come until much later in the season.
So then we had a fairly thin or shallow snowpack that was sitting on the ground. And with the cold temperatures, that snow started to rot. So it just became more and more faceted, weaker. And then we bring in snow on top of that and overload it. So we create that strong snow with a lot of snow all at once from a storm and wind that compacts the snow. And wind will pick snow up from the windward side of the slope and transport it over to the lee or the sheltered side of the slope and create a slab or an upside down snowpack. So you end up having strong snow over weak snow. And if the slope is steep enough to create an avalanche, then you're just waiting for a trigger.
Right. End of January to beginning of February, we had 15 people die in the U.S. from avalanches. And I just wonder maybe your thought process and in why there were so many in that seven-day period.
Certainly, I think the pandemic has driven more people into the mountains. Families and individuals have found that it might be safest to recreate outside. Starting in March, with the closure of so many ski resorts, a lot of people turned to ski touring into the backcountry in order to recreate outside in a perhaps safer way from a pandemic standpoint, but certainly in a less controlled environment than a ski resort.
And I think one of the most interesting things about I've seen kind of your work online, and one of your most popular presentations is, you know, your it's titled "It's Not Chess, It's Poker." So if maybe you can kind of explain what you mean by that.
So I read a fascinating book called "Thinking and Bets" by Annie Duke, and she looks at how we can make better decisions living in an uncertain world. And as an avalanche educator, I've found that I have students who want to treat their own personal backcountry decisions as chess rather than poker. Duke points out in her book that chess is really a game of skill and pattern recognition. All the pieces are there for both players to see. If you lose, it's because you have a lack of skill, not because of a lack of luck. Poker, on the other hand, has a lot of uncertainty. You can have a bad hand, but use skill to win, or you can have a good hand, but be unskilled and lose. There's a combination of luck and skill. And I think backcountry skiing is the same. There's always some degree of uncertainty that's going to play into our outcomes on a day ski touring. We have great information that we're getting all the time, but there is still some amount of uncertainty that means we can never make backcountry skiing 100% safe. There are things we can do to make it safer and to tip the odds in our favor.
Right. And I think an interesting part about that is, you know, with avalanches, you can see even expert backcountry skiers get into accidents or even, you know, unfortunately die, even though they have done all these avalanche trainings. They supposedly have done, you know, the safety and they know what to do. So I guess it's just important to be aware that it's just a dangerous sport. But, you know, with that being said, what are some things that people can do in order to try to be as safe as possible?
We all have the capacity to make mistakes. I think arming yourself with knowledge is really important. And one of the hardest things about getting started in backcountry skiing is that more often than not, we don't know what we don't know. It's a brand new world for us. And so it's important to try to take a class. There are a lot of online avalanche education classes available now. Learn how to read the forecast. Find mentors in your community. Take a backcountry 101 or a level one avalanche class. And I think recognize that this is a lifelong pursuit. You're never going to get to the point of mastering the mountains, you know, as you might master a game like chess.
As you mentioned, with the pandemic, it seems that more people are going outdoors and more people are discovering backcountry skiing or snowshoeing or snowmobiling or whatever it is in the backcountry. If this trend sticks, that there's more people out in the backcountry, do we need to change the way we do it? Is something going to have to change if there's more people in the backcountry more now?
It's a good question. Probably. I think that as you gain skill, you feel more competent to go further afield, deeper into the wilderness and further away. And you're then more likely to find solitude and find untracked snow. But scarcity has likely contributed to some close calls, at least in the backcountry this year. So I think this idea that we have a limited resource in untracked slopes, especially with the problematic snowpack. And so a lot of people are attracted to the same terrain. I think increased communication, you know, among touring parties and being willing to walk further are both useful skills. My hope is certainly that we have enough public land and skiable terrain that things don't have to be regulated any more than they are.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jenna.
Yeah. Thank you, Camilla.
Let's change direction. Things are very dry in the Colorado River Basin already this year, and the situation could get much worse for the water that 40 million people across seven western states rely on. Luke Runyon explains the current drought conditions in five numbers.
Let's start with 84%. That's the amount of land in the river's upper watershed experiencing extreme to exceptional drought. It's the highest percentage since 2002, which is the region's driest year on record.
This is when we're supposed to be gaining and accumulating water in the form of snowpack. And that's not happening.
Nancy Sellever is Arizona's state climatologist. She says conditions have been deteriorating across the river basin since last summer. Monsoon rains didn't arrive, and record-breaking high temperatures dragged well into fall. Even hardy desert plants, the ones well adapted to water scarcity, have struggled.
Creosote is one, I personally like to call it the cockroach of the vegetation world, because pretty much nothing kills creosote. I mean, it survives.
But even they're dying, she says. Exceptional drought is a category that is supposed to capture the severity, but also the frequency of an extended dry period. Climate scientists call it D4. And for context, there's nothing beyond exceptional on the scale of no drought to worse drought.
And the D4 category is something that is only supposed to be designated when you're seeing conditions that are so extreme, they're only happening once every 50 to once every 100 years.
That's Becky Bollinger, Colorado's assistant state climatologist. That takes us to our second number, 3. That's how many exceptional droughts the basin has seen in the last 20 years.
And the droughts that we are seeing are becoming that much more severe because of the temperature component. They're warmer.
Which means the atmosphere is thirstier. It sucks up moisture from forests and crop fields with greater intensity. In parts of the basin, Bollinger says climate change has caused conditions on the ground to bump up against these designated drought categories.
And even though conditions may be evolving and getting even worse, we don't really have a way to depict that because D4, that's that ceiling, that's that absolute worst.
In droughts like this, you run out of superlatives. The dryness is currently off the charts in parts of the watershed. John Meyer is with the Utah Climate Center. The number that captures the severity for him is 12 inches.
And that's about the amount of water that our soils are behind in terms of what they normally would have.
That deficit is about the same amount of precipitation that falls in Utah in an entire year.
We are really in unprecedented territory right now, and it's not even close.
And because the deficit is so substantial, it's very unlikely we'll see any sustained drought recovery this year.
It doesn't matter if we get an incredible snowpack. Our soils are so depleted right now that that's not going to really translate to water coming down through the river systems.
That gets us to our next number, 46%. According to John Fleck, that's how full the Colorado River's biggest reservoirs are combined. Fleck runs the Water Resources Program at the University of New Mexico.
These reservoirs are as empty now as when they started filling Glen Canyon Dam in the 1960s.
With the reservoirs less than half full, that brings us to our final number, 2026. That's the deadline for water users to come up with a new set of managing guidelines for the Colorado River.
The challenges are really hard, and it's easy to put them off if you get a wet year. And the dry years are what force the really important steps forward in the policy community.
Extremely dry years that produce eye-popping statistics tend to grab officials by the shoulders and give them a good shake. And that's important for the entire region, Fleck says, because the future of the Colorado River is going to be all about learning to live with less. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC, with financial support from the Walton Family Foundation. Many people think of science and art as complete opposites, but one University of Wyoming researcher is working to combine the two. Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone spoke with Karen Vaughn, a pedology professor who's using the soil in her research to make watercolor paint. She says soil is more important than you would think.
I mean, soils are important for so many different reasons. The obvious ones that we are in touch with every single day is the food that we eat and the plants that we rely on to, you know, cycle our air. Gosh, I don't know how to summarize the importance of soil, but I mean, it's part of everything. I challenge my students to tell me one thing that you did today that did not rely on the soil. And I still haven't gotten a single answer that I'm satisfied with that does not have to do with the soil.
When did you start turning soil into paint, and like what kind of gave you that idea?
So I've always been fascinated with color. As a soil scientist, we use color as a tool to tell us what's going on below ground. You know, what do these different minerals mean, or how deep does the organic matter go and how dark is that profile? But I only started making watercolors from soil about 2 years ago. And it was really one particular soil that made it happen. And it was a soil that had purples and pinks and yellows and oranges. And we're actually in Tennessee. And it was like, gosh, this soil is gorgeous. Like, what should we do with it? You know, it felt like it needed more than just pictures. And so I collected a little from each of the different horizons. And I eventually came home and made pigments out of it. And then from there, it was more of an awakening. I was like, wait a minute, I deal with soil every single day. All the soils, you know, in and around Wyoming that are part of my research sites are also beautiful. And they're subtle and they're earth tones, but those are colors that really speak to people. So just went from there.
What is it that actually gives the soil those different colors?
Creating art with earth pigments, I would venture to say, is probably the first art form. This is nothing new. I mean, think about all of the art that's been created forever. It started with iron oxides and clays and charcoal. In soils, one of the really common pigmenting agents is iron oxides. I should say are, because they come in a range of colors, you know, from yellow, orange, red, purple, just some beautiful colors that you might not even think. And then there's other minerals as well that the greens are harder to find, the blues are harder to find. But if you live in Wyoming, you've probably seen green and blue soil, but most other people have not had that opportunity.
Okay. I'm curious if you have a favorite color or soil that you've found before.
My favorite color is brown. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it's so fitting for a soil scientist. Actually, you know, sometimes I say my favorite color is brown. The other time I say my favorite color is the rainbow. And that's the answer my kids give. And I love it. So I get excited every single time I mull up another color because it's new to me. You know, it might have looked one color in place. And then when you wet it up and it seems so enhanced. And so it's just fun exploring the different colors that are out there in an entirely different way by making paint.
What are some examples of people who have used this paint?
You know, it's really interesting. We've recently started selling some of these watercolors to generate income to do other sort of science outreach activities. And the audience that is coming forward are these just artists that are curious about natural resources and soil and, you know, learning more about nature. So that's one part of the audience. The other part are scientists that are like, hey, neat. I've never really thought about doing art because I'm a scientist, but you're allowed to do art no matter what you're labeled as. So we hope everyone will give it a try.
Can you tell me why you think it's so important to kind of connect science and art together?
So I'm using watercolor paints as a vehicle to communicate about the science that I feel really passionate about, so soil science. And I think the art is just a way that people open their eyes to different ways of thinking. you know, something that they hadn't thought of soil as being beautiful before. And I just love that, you know, we're not going to hook everyone, but there are certainly some people out there that are going to start seeing soil differently.
That was University of Wyoming Assistant Professor of Podology Karen Vaughn talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone. When we come back, we will wrap up the program with a look at how a Laramie company is developing a new rapid COVID-19 test that will soon be widely available. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Quick and accurate COVID-19 testing is a key part of getting the pandemic under control, and a Laramie company is part of the effort to make that a reality. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel talked to CellDrop Biosciences founder Ben Noren.
We use materials called hydrogels. So if you think of Jell-O, it's probably the most ubiquitous example of a hydrogel. Hydrogels make up a lot of what's in your body. And so using sort of synthetic hydrogels, we're able to recreate things like the spaces that cells live inside of yourself. This particular project was based out of kind of using hydrogel like a sponge and taking these what's called lateral flow immunoassay tests, which basically detect various biological substances in a sample like saliva, but doing it in a way that worked better than what existed, because unlike existing tests, we could build these hydrogel structures, very, very small length scales, dehydrate them, and when we put a sample like saliva into them, they would rehydrate and suck all of the things in towards these little sponge-like hydrogel structures, and it enabled us to basically detect whatever's in them a lot faster because they have the advantage of pulling everything into the surface that they're being detected on. And it works for any sort of test, but when the COVID situation began to develop, we were like, oh, you know, we have the perfect technology for this.
Is that what kind of makes yours different, is the fact that it's dehydrated?
It is one of the key things that makes it different, is that because we have this cool hydrogel technology that nobody else is using, that we have patented, we are able to detect substances in our sample faster. And that in and of itself is pretty cool. But we sort of had this bigger vision where we could create a test that was not only faster, but would be able to detect smaller amounts of substances. So, you know, another issue with some of the rapid tests that are on the market is they're not very sensitive. One of our collaborators in this project is Metrum Ramen, which is a company that has a base of operations in Laramie. And we've partnered with them to basically produce these cool little handheld detectors that will enable us to, in under 5 minutes, detect these very, very small amounts of, in this case, COVID-19 that are in these samples. And so that is something else that makes our process unique. We do something called service enhanced ramen, or SERS, but it's very, very sensitive. And we can do this with just their little handheld instrument. And so that kind of is another part of our overall process that is unique, and that when it's all said and done will enable us to sort of fulfill a niche that we will be able to detect this lower level of COVID-19 than other tests could detect.
So with being that sensitive, do you see a possible issue with giving false positives?
Yeah, that is definitely something we want to watch out for, right? And the cool thing about this technology is we're able to tune it, and that's kind of what we're working on right now, is tuning it so that it does not, you know, go overboard and just keep returning false positives all the time. And by basically having it at a level where it will return positive results for the most at-risk patients, so people who have very, very low levels of SARS-CoV-2 are unlikely to spread it, and it's the people who are shedding virus who have these higher levels that will spread it and are at the most risk of infecting others. And so we want our system to be able to basically tell you whether or not it's safe for you to go to the grocery store or to go into a big event like a sports arena or on an airplane. And it can say with 98% accuracy that, yeah, you are good to go outside. You're not going to infect anybody. That's kind of how we are moving forward and the part of our development that we're working on right now.
How widespread will this be?
Right now, we are working on two variants of this test. So the one that we are moving forward with right now is a version that will be available to medical clinics, to people who are working at a sporting arena, on an airplane, that type of situation where you spit in our little device, you hand it over to the person, they stick it in the reader. In around 3 minutes, it will return whether or not you're safe to go about your business. And that enables basically a much higher degree of certainty about not spreading it. At the same time, and using very similar technology, we're also developing a at-home version, which sort of eschews the handheld reader and would be perhaps a simple color test, but it would still use the patented sponge hydrogel technology. So it would be a leg up on what's currently available in that it would return results faster and it would be more sensitive because that sponge sucking in any sort of viral particles would concentrate whatever is in that sample automatically. And so you would be able to, with high reliability, detect what's in that. It wouldn't be quite as sensitive as the handheld detector that we're currently working on, but it would provide a sort of like easy at-home solution where you could just like grab one in the morning when you're brushing your teeth and be like, oh, COVID's safe today.
About how much are these tests going to cost? Is it going to be feasible for every venue to have one and every person to have one at home? Or is it going to be something that it's going to take a while to get the cost down to where just anyone can have it?
Yeah, so the components of the test are easy to obtain, and there's nothing that is, you know, super fancy or takes a lot of time and effort to produce. And those are all great, great things for when you're producing a test that needs to be scaled and scaled up in a very big way, because it more or less means that we can produce them inexpensively. There's no roadblocks to that. And so we don't have the partners to really know exactly what it's going to cost in the end. We do know that the materials that will be made out of are inexpensive and that the test itself is designed in such a way that it can be scaled easily. And that will make it cost effective.
What's the timeline that you're kind of looking at right now?
We would love to be able to start manufacturing these and getting them out by this summer. And we are doing the very best we can to make our portion of it happen. And a lot of it is going to be just from a scaling point of view, how fast can we get companies to source the materials, build the test, and then figure out how to get it to the people. And that's the big unknown. From the science technology development aspect, it's going really well, better than science goes in general. It's usually slower. So that part of it is really encouraging.
All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Yeah. Thank you, Ivy.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear an archive of the show or individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can find a podcast version of the program as well at all the usual places. Anna Rader is our digital editor. We also invite you to check out our other podcasts and to sign up for our Facebook page. Support our local news effort, including this show, with your pledge. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.